When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mike Duncan of the History of Rome and Revolutions, David Crowther of the History of England, and Kevin Stroud of the History of English will all be in the same place at the same time at a day devoted to thought-provoking podcast infotainment. On June 29, from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m, the Agora Podcast Network will be presenting the Intelligent Speech Conference in New York City. In addition to Mike Duncan, David Crowther and Kevin Stroud, some of your favorite Agora Podcast Network hosts will also be there, including Royfield Brown of Mid-Atlantic, 10 American Presidents and How Jamaica Conquered the World, Eric Fogg of Reconsider, Steve Guerra of the History of the Papacy podcast, Claude Myron Guza of the Cannonball podcast, Aziz Al-Dori of the History of Westeros podcast, Raven of Tiny Vampires, and Benjamin Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia. With all these amazingly talented individuals, you may be worried that there are too many for one day, but there will be three conference rooms featuring panels, talks, and laser tag. Okay, there will not be any laser tag, but definitely a full day of panels and talks from a dozen of the best podcasters on the planet. You can get tickets to the Intelligent Speech Conference by going to intelligentspeechconference.com. Mike Duncan, David Crowther, and Kevin Stroud live and in person. Simply go to intelligentspeechconference.com.
Tears unnumbered ye shall shed, and the Valar will fence Valinor against you and shut you out, so that not even the echo of your lamentation shall pass over the mountains. On the house of Fëanor, the wrath of the Valar lieth from the west unto the uttermost east, and upon all that will follow them it shall be laid also. Their oath shall drive them and yet betray them, and ever snatch away the very treasures they have sworn to pursue. To evil end shall all things turn, that they begin well, and by treason of kin unto kin, and the fear of treason, shall this come to pass. The dispossessed shall they be for ever. Ye have spilled the blood of your kindred unrighteously, and have stained the land of Aman. For blood ye shall render blood, and beyond a man ye shall dwell in death's shadow. For though Eru appointed you not to die in Ea, and no sickness may assail you, yet slain ye may be, and slain ye shall be, by weapons and by torment and by grief, and your houseless spirit shall come then to Mandos. There long shall ye abide and yearn for your bodies, and find little pity, though all whom ye have slain should entreat for you. And those that endure in Middle-earth, and come not to Mandos, shall grow weary of the world as with a great burden, and shall wane and become as shadows of regret before the younger race that cometh after. The Valar have spoken.
Imagine, if you will, a people who have been wronged, who feel persecuted, who have struck out into the world to make a fresh start, to claim a new freedom. Imagine a nation in search of a homeland, a place where they can be secure and prosper and enjoy the fruits of their own labor. Who are you imagining? Pilgrims with buckled shoes? Boer farmers? Israeli settlers? You could just as easily be talking about the Noldor, a clan of high elves who accepted the invitation of the Valar to join them in Eldamar, the Undying Lands, where they lived for ages upon ages in untold bliss before dissension, distrust, and jealousy was sown amongst them by the Dark Lord Melkor, sparking a journey of great courage, of fleeting glory, and incalculable suffering for themselves and for all whom they came across. In this special Agora Network original podcast, Daniel Doughty from The Cannonball, Benjamin Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia, and myself, Tom Daly, of American Biography, will be discussing these elves who returned to Beleriand in Middle-earth with the light of Aman not yet dimmed in their eyes, who were strong and swift and deadly in anger, and whose swords were long and terrible. So joining me today to talk about Noldor colonialism is Daniel Doughty from The Cannonball.
Hey, y'all.
And Ben Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia.
Greetings.
So, guys, we are met here today to discuss an undervalued Tolkienian bit of writing. I think most of what we're discussing today will probably be from the Silmarillion. So now, before you stop this recording, hear us out. This is worthy, and you should all give this a serious listen. And I think you're gonna get a kick out of the stuff we talk about today.
Yeah, and just for everybody listening at home, I can personally vouch for the fact that this was way more engaging than I thought it was going to be, because I, unlike my two fellow interlocutors here, I was a newbie to the Silmarillion. Although I had read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, you know, way back when, and have read it a couple of times since then, I had never read anything from the Silmarillion or any of the kind of extended, what's the term? Legendarium, I think is the term people use for it, of the, of sort of, you know, Tolkien's other work. And I was absolutely charmed. I thought it was really lovely. So there you go, everybody. That's my personal stamp of approval. Yeah.
And I'll just say, even though I was heavily sedated at the time when I read it, I had literally broken my back. But I really enjoy the Silmarillion in general. And once you've gotten past, you know, you've done the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, and you've dug a little bit into the universe, the Silmarillion is just wonderful. It has so much Tolkien in it. You know, this whole, like, Catholic cosmology, Catholic / Greek cosmology that he sets up. You can just see so much of him in it. And it's, you know, it's in the best possible way.
I would say, like, Catholic Greek cosmology with a heavy dose of Gnosticism in there. And I would have the Inquisition... Yes. Take a look at Mr. J.R.R.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of, you know, emanations from the prime unmoved mover, you know.
Right, emanations and sub-deities. And,
But to be fair, you know, at the time, in the 40s and everything, that was totally legit. That was very...
I guess that's true in the scholarship of non-Orthodox Christianities. Of course, the great boom times were yet to come, because the Nag Hammadi library hadn't been discovered and published yet.
Anyway, we can.
He didn't know he was a heretic.
And then just what we were kind of just chatting about before we started recording, it's you have to come to this this text with a different mindset. If you have read The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you're going to expect the wrong thing. And you're going to be dissatisfied, and you're going to put it down. But I think, like I said, it's so beautifully written. The language that Tolkien's used, he's such a master of language, and I mean, he's a philologist. So I mean, he thinks of words, he knows words that you don't, and he just manages to be such a smith with them.
He's very into the concept of prose as song, and yes, really, I mean, it's a recurring theme in all of his works, and the power of song, the power of words, and that just really comes through in the work. And we should say that if you haven't read it, it's a series of stories. If you're going to it expecting one narrative, it's not that. It's a series of legends, essentially.
Yeah, it's like a series of sort of like it, how I would think of it as like you guys know about in the Golden Legend, right? The medieval compilation of saints' lives that was like the best-selling book besides the Bible for like a long time. Yeah. Like we have more like of the stuff that survives from the Middle Ages, half of it is copies of the Golden Legend. it's kind of like that. It's like an in-universe version of that, because it's like a collection of like the legends that people in the setting would have told each other and would have been how the mythic past was remembered. And so the actual prose itself is very I don't want to say fable-ish, but it's sort of written in the kind of cadence of, and not exactly storybook either, but it's not like a straight up narrative like you would expect.
Well, he very consciously was engaged in a project of story building, of legend building, and he was very influenced by the Kalevala, the Finnish national epic, and a lot of the Anglo-Saxon old stories, being that he was a PhD in Anglo-Saxon. So. But we're maybe a little bit off topic.
We immediately got off topic, but to kind of just...
Which is appropriate for a Silmarillion show.
Yeah. But now that you guys have our strong endorsement that you should go ahead and grab a copy of this book and give it a good read, we're gonna circle back now to our purpose here today. And when you get into reading it, there's one definitive story arc that we can kind of zoom down on, because it's a mile-high treatment that Tolkien is giving the millennia that pass over the course of the Silmarillion story. But if we zoom in on one specific group of elves and the journey that they take and the actions they make in order to get a hold of these jewels called the Simarils, from whence the Silmarillion takes its name, we can isolate that and we can see some very familiar actions that we see in our own history. Yeah. And most specifically that we're going to talk about today is colonialism. And I don't know, Ben, do you want to sort of take us through that background? Or
yeah, sure. I can do it. Yeah, if you want. So The Silmarillion is sort of split into three sections. The first one is sort of the full-on background with, gods and the creation of the universe and everything. The second one is what we're going to talk about, and then the third one happens between the other events and the start of The Lord of the Rings. So for that second one, the actual Quetta Silmarillion. So to set it up from the first part, the Valar are essentially... you could call them archangels or something like that, or gods, however you want to describe it. They're illuminations of Iluvatar, who is the unmoved mover. And they help him create the world, and then they come down into it and join it. But one of their number, Melkor, is evil. And in the process of creating the world, they put up with him for a while, and then eventually, when elves start to show up, they beat the tar out of him and put him in prison. So they lived in a place called the Undying Lands with the elves that they brought over. The elves had sort of emerged in the far east of the world and gradually moved west, some of them settling along the way. Eventually, one of the Valar found them, beat up Melkor, brought them over, and then everything was great. There were three groups of elves, including the Noldor, one of the Noldor was Fëanor, who made some shiny MacGuffins that we call the Silmarils. Middle-earth, which was the other part, away from the Undying Lands, that was inhabited by other elves who hadn't made it across to the Undying Lands. There were also dwarves, ents, orcs, etc. Melkor was released from prison for good behavior, and then abused his parole by forming an alliance with a giant spider. and after sowing some discord during his time when he was wandering around freely, and getting, you know, some bad blood up between the different elvish groups, he and the spider came in, messed up a bunch of stuff, killed some people, stole the Silmarils, and escaped back to Middle-earth, and then he began building up his power.
Can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
I just wanted to add some nomenclature to this. you know, so all the elves, as Ben pointed out, awoke later than the Valar. They awoke by a lake called Quivienen. The group of elves, and you think of them as a clan almost, the Vanyar, the Noldor, and the Thelmari, all traveled west with the Valar all the way to the Undying Lands to live with them. Along the way, some more groups just stopped the migration. So if you hear us talk about the Nandor, they're people who stopped at the Misty Mountains and didn't move further west into the land where most of the action's going to be happening, which is called Beleriand. Those that did later become known as the Sindar, and they're going to be a major player along with the Noldor in the rest of our story.
Right. And so basically, the key part of this story is that after Melkor came through and stole the Silmarils, Feanor, who was the most industrious and thus the most prideful of the Noldor, he talked to the rest of the Noldor. I mean, he was pretty angry, and so he talked to the rest of the Noldor into traveling with him back to Middle-earth to get his gems back. And get his revenge, despite the fact that the Valar thought that this was a bad idea. And they were so committed to this idea that they defied the Valar and, oh, by the way, killed some of the other elves to steal their ships, at which point they were banished by the Valar. Feanor didn't have enough ships to get across the sea, though, so he basically, in one of my favorite set pieces, he and his buddies and his clan, his immediate family, got on the ships and told the other Noldor to wait there. He'd be right back, and then he left and didn't come back and burned the ships.
So we're dealing with just like a really cool guy.
Yeah,
just a really good dude.
Yeah, Feanor's he's a character.
Now, just to like show him up, though, these elves who had already, you know, sort of made their choice, they didn't just turn around and go back cap in hand to the Valar and ask for forgiveness. They decided to walk. Now, how, you might think, do you walk between the Undying Lands and Middle-earth when there's an ocean in between? Well, if you keep going north, there's an area called the Grinding Ice, which is what it sounds like, and somehow they made it across, mostly led by Thingolfin. Yeah. They were not very happy with Feanor when they got down and found him there with, like, kingdoms and stuff all set up. And they were like, dude, and he was like, oh, you made it!
You guys!
Oh, hey! How'd you guys? Yeah, so good to see you! So, basically then, the Noldor set about attacking Melkor in his fortress. Feanor was killed pretty quickly, and the whole thing became a stalemate that the Noldor and their allies gradually lost. One thing I should just say, I was just going back over some plot synopses and stuff. While all the Noldor were doing their thing, when Melkor first got to Middle-earth, the first thing he did was try and attack the Sindar elves, and they kicked his ass.
They did.
Right. And that's why he was hanging out in a fortress, rather than, like, ruling anything when the Noldor showed up. So I think it's very important to point out that the Sindar, because of what we're about to talk about, the Sindar weren't, you know, sitting around going, oh, we need to be liberated, everything is so terrible. They sort of had things in hand.
Yeah. Yeah, they were doing well for themselves.
And then the Noldor show up with their blood curse and everything, and the kin slaying.
Yeah, and I guess we should mention the that blood curse you're talking about is the when Feanor was, like, getting everybody amped to go ride with him across the ocean to beat up a god and steal back his gems, he made everyone swear this mighty oath. And I thought this was very interesting And I think it will have, I think it's one of those things that has a lot of resonance in this story to our own time and our own circumstances. Our own time, as though this is actually set in the real past. Our own circumstances on planet Earth. But this, just for the kind of sake of like, just sort of generational grudge kind of stuff, that Fëanor induces his followers to take this oath where they must at all times, you know, strive to recover the Silmarils and also strive against anyone who would keep them from going to get the Silmarils. And this is binding through the generations. And like, if you, and I don't know the exact like details of it, but like, if you like enter into like treaty with people who are under the oath, then the oath also passes on to you. And like, it's real, you know, it's sort of this expanding morass of violent obligation.
Yeah.
that goes on. Fëanor's
sons will take this oath and it'll constantly drive them to do, you know, increasingly desperate things, but it does affect everybody around them.
No, sure. And to be clear, what this oath requires you to do is attempt to physically beat and take something from this universe's literal Satan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think at the outset,
so it's pretty gnarly stuff. Yeah.
At the outset, I think it's worth pointing out that the Noldor's entire quest is vain and hopeless from the first.
Yeah.
They never possessed the power to ever fulfill any of the oaths.
Right.
Like, they were never going to beat him.
Right.
But
spoilers, the group that eventually beats him has to hit him so hard that a continent falls into the ocean.
Yeah.
And the elves are great, but they're not, you know, continent smashing great.
Right. They're not. Well, I was going to say, like, it is kind of like, and I don't know if it's just sort of from familiarity, because of course Fëanor and these Noldor they're over there in the Undying Lands where they get to rub shoulders with the gods from time to time. They're hanging out with them in this, you know, in this paradisical land where there's no night and day, but everything is illuminated by great legendary lantern trees that just, you know, bathe everything in magical light, you know? So it is kind of like, on the one hand, it can be like, well, you know, what did you think was going to happen, dude? You're taking on Satan. But on the other hand, it's like, oh yeah, but like, the Archangel Michael lives down the street from you.
Right.
I know these people.
Right.
I know these guys.
All right. I think maybe to start, we just zoom in here on a couple of these things that we just glossed over, because I think it's important to try to get into the mindset of the Noldor. So as Ben mentioned, it all started basically when Melkor got paroled from his ages in, you know, Valar jail. And he begins sowing dissension with the Noldor, who he finds more susceptible. And it's something that happens over and over in Tolkien. You know, the greater you are, you know, almost the harder you're going to fall. And Fëanor, I think, has been, you know, pointed out, he was probably considered the greatest elf that ever lived. The greatest craftsman, you know, he created the first alphabet.
Or, you know, we should say the most talented. Yeah. You know, great is a moral judgment. Right. Like,
great is a moral judgment.
He's a huge jerk, but
he's terrible.
Extraordinarily talented.
But he had the potential to be the greatest,
right?
Possibly,
right? And I think you hit upon, and this is something that, of course, Tolkien, it's a major theme across all his works, is that it's pridefulness, which is the root of these falls. And it makes sense because, of course, the Ur fall, like what turned Melkor bad, was that when all the Valar were together, literally singing the world into being, according to the kind of composition that Iluvatar, the Unmoved Mover, had come up with for them. Melkor kind of felt that basically everything went pear-shaped when one of those guys tried to upstage the conductor and come up with his own sort of jazz riffs, and it didn't really jive with everything.
It did not jive.
So it kind of makes sense that the repercussions throughout this cosmos that was created through those acts are such that, you know, anyone who does think of themselves as like, well, wait a minute, I know better what's going on here, I need to be the one who has the spotlight, they're going to be most susceptible to the whispers of Morgoth, you know, just just because they're, you know, they're peas in a pod, really. Right.
So, yeah. And I think it's also worth mentioning that, you know, when it comes to his pride, he's also the prince. Feanor's father, Finwë, is the king of the Noldor. And upon his... Ben mentioned that Melkor messed up a bunch of stuff. Some of that, well, he killed two beautiful trees that gave the world light, and whose light filled the Simurgh. And he killed Finwë, Feanor's father. So not only did he steal the most precious things, precious jewels of Feanor's, but he killed his father. So there's like a double blood vengeance.
Right.
That is totally driving Feanor, you know, past sanity. So when he's motivating the other Noldor to leave the Undying Lands and go to Beleriand, he's not just selling them, go get my jewels. You know, don't you want vengeance for your king? And while you're and while we're at it, guys, we're brave people, you know, worthy of glory and great deeds, and we should be able to rule our own realms in our own name, and we shouldn't be sitting at the feet of the Valar who can't even protect us in the Undying Lands. And that is really where we're going to start to touch on, I think, the basis for the colonization of Beleriand by the Noldor.
And just really quickly, as you know, tying into that, it should just be said now, before we get into later stuff, that, you know, given that they were hanging out with literal gods in the Undying Lands and everything, they learned a lot of, and this is sort of a, you know, an Asimov, the highest, you know, technology and magic are the same thing kind of thing. Where they're hanging out with the people who literally created the universe. So they learned a whole lot of things that people who hadn't hung out in the Undying Lands wouldn't necessarily have had access to. So,
yes, and those trees are important, and I name them for a reason, because it's basking in the light of those trees actually physically changes the Noldor and the other ones, the other elves that went to live with the Valar. And so they're actually going to have a physical difference from the other ones.
Because, editorializing here a little bit, Being a good Catholic, Tolkien didn't believe in evolution. He was a fan of the competing theory of acquired traits. So,
okay.
So having...
right. Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say that's also, I mean, it's sort of important for the, when we're talking about sort of the colonial aspects of the story, in that there is, you know, much as the doctrine of racism was... you know, basically only possible and was invented around the time that a large number of people of fairly obvious different phenotypes were going to interact with each other. So that physical appearance became ideologically important. I think that's, I think the fact that the Noldor are themselves, you know, physically distinct in a way that cannot be mistaken is, you know, is important.
So having seen the light of the trees, it like shines, it radiates from their faces and they're greater. And they are called Kalaquendi. And the ones and elves that never saw the trees, never made that journey, are going to be called Moraquendi. So if we drop those words later, that's what they mean.
But then there's also the gray elves, whose leaders went over to the Undying Lands, saw the trees, and then came back to get them, but then never quite made it.
So, yeah, so exactly.
We call them the split the difference.
There's a whole grayscale of elves, basically, is what we're talking about. Printing jokes, everybody. Printing jokes.
So I think there's one passage I want to read real quick. It's not very long, but I think it shows the effects of Feanor on the followers that will go with him to Beleriand. And this is from Galadriel's point of view, who's most famous from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but makes several brief appearances in the Silmarillion. The passage goes, "Galadriel, the only woman of the Noldor to stand that day, tall and valiant among the contending princes, was eager to be gone. No oaths she swore, but the words of Feanor concerning Middle-earth had kindled in her heart for she yearned to see the wide unguarded lands and to rule there a realm at her own will. Of like mind with Galadriel was Fingon, Fingolfin's son, being moved also by Feanor's words, though he loved him little. And with Fingon stood, as they ever did, Angrod and Egnor, sons of Finarfin. Now, those are all pretty high-ranking people that they just named, along with Galadriel. And you see, at the motivation, is forget, Galadriel doesn't care about the jewels. She doesn't care about Finwë. She wants to rule a realm at her own will, and so do these other Noldor. And they're not going to be able to do that in the Undying Lands.
Right, because you got those pesky gods, you know, actually ruling things there. But and the I guess the established, yeah, you know, established dynasties or what have you. Yeah, they're actual, like, I guess polities we might call them there. Yeah, you're right. But it's all carved up. So, you know, where are the second son's going to go to call up a hoary old crusading theory?
They can join the church. I mean...
That's right. Well, yeah, I mean, how do you have a church when you just look up and see the god and wave at it? Come on.
All right, we're going to be accusing them of being colonizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's our working definition of that? How do we want to define colonialism for the show?
I mean, we can define the historical phenomenon in terms of people coming from somewhere else and attempting to establish ownership of an area that already has inhabitants, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fair, I think, working definition, and I think it's good because it gets at the nub of it when, and also because the thing about colonialism, at least in, you know, the honestly in this Silmarillion, in Tolkien's universe, and, you know, and the actual universe we inhabit, is that it was an extremely varied phenomenon. There were all kinds of ways it was accomplished for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we already kind of hit upon that, right? Because, like, the, you know, Feanor's Noldor are there for, you know, vengeance and jewels. you know, Galadriel is just like, you know, well, I want to be queen of somewhere. you know, right. Like, there are any number of, you know, reasons why it might be pursued. But, right, that I think, you know, the sort of... people moving from one region of the world to another in order to establish political dominance over a region which already has inhabitants, which will necessarily have to be politically dominated by the newcomers.
Right. And so there's also a couple comorbid conditions, if you will, that the incoming group has to be militarily, technologically, politically superior in some way to the people that they're imposing themselves on, just from a practical standpoint of actually imposing themselves. If they were weaker, they wouldn't succeed in establishing their political dominance. And of course, one of the general themes of real world colonialism has been an inferred moral dominance as a part of that, which is of course not borne out factually,
right, but is essential to the colonizer ideology. We might say.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. And hence why the dichotomy of Caliquendi, Moriquendi is noteworthy. But as Ben pointed out, Beleriand is not empty. It is, you know, much like Mexico, when Cortez arrived, there was a highly sophisticated... you know, centralized kingdom with secure borders and all that jazz, and who had discovered swords independently of the Noldor, who were the ones who created them in the Undying Lands,
and had already kicked Melkor's behind,
kicked Melkor's behind, and of course we're speaking of Thingol in his kingdom of Doriath, though he was entirely besieged. His realm was perfectly secure, and they could not topple him. But they were sent the orcs of Morgoth, or, sorry, Melkor. He has two names. Were essentially overrunning the rest of the continent when the Noldor arrived, and that plays an important role because when the Noldor, hit the beaches, they do sweep up the orcs and deliver their own devastating defeat and drive his forces back to Thangorodrim, which is Melkor's main base, essentially. Yeah. And they set up a leaguer. They besiege him for something like 500 years there. But in the process...
Keeping in mind, I think it's important to remind everyone that everyone here is immortal.
Well,
humans haven't showed up yet.
Slain they can be, and slain they shall be, according to the words of Mandos. So they're able to be killed, but they don't get sick or get old, essentially.
Yeah.
But Feanor, in fact, is killed very shortly after after arriving.
Because he made a variety of bad decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
He single-handedly picked a fight with multiple Balrogs.
Which is never a good idea.
Well, hey, man, he is... Yeah, it's not a good idea, but he had the love of jewels on his side. So, you know, I thought that would take him pretty far, but I was wrong.
Look, I like Jewel too, but you know...
But I swear, after that 2003 Intuition album, I just can't. It just can't motivate me anymore. Sorry, guys. I guess I should explain.
No,
I worked at an ice cream stand at the time, so I'm deeply familiar with the top 40 of the year 2003-2004.
No, thank you.
Just because it was constantly played every day. So
no, seriously. Forgive me. Thank you for finishing that joke for me, because I only owned the one album. I actually like it that much.
Thingol. Thingol, so he's in Doriath with his wife, who is like almost a Valar. She's a Maiar, which is like a junior Valar. So his people, the Sindar.
She's an angel instead of an archangel.
Yes.
Yeah.
So his people are the Grey Elves. They are made greater than your average elf because they live with Melian the Maia and Thingol, who had visited Valinor and came back. So he had seen the tree. So he's Caliquendi. So they're raised up a little bit more, but they're not like the Noldor. And so that creates the situation where the Noldor have Melkor kind of blockaded in his fortress. They have Thingol in his kingdom. And then all the princelings sort of decide, we're going to start to section off different parts of Beleriand and rule them in our own name, which was one of our goals at the outset.
Which, to be fair, in a pre-modern society, a feudal method of land ownership and control is probably a natural thing. Sorry.
Right. It just kind of happens when kinship relations are given that much social primacy.
Of course. You know, it's natural. So, in terms of how this translates into colonialism, though, I mean, there's all these other people there, too. There's dwarves, there's the Dark Elves, which Tom probably knows the word for better than me.
Morquendi.
Morquendi.
Morquendi,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What are their relationships with the Noldor like?
The Morquendi's relationship with them? Let's see. So, basically, the Noldor, their kingdoms that they set up aren't just Noldor living there. They sort of bring in... You know, all comers, all other elves are allowed to live under their beneficent monarchies.
Yeah.
Right. And just play their part as commoners, essentially.
Right.
Right. There'll never be, you know, there's definitely an elite caste of blood Noldor, and then anyone else is welcome to live under their rule, but one's ever going to break into that upper caste.
Yeah. Now, there we see a couple really snapshots of behavior between interaction between them. And one of the little stories Tolkien tells is about a guy named Eol, who is a dark elf. They call him Dark Elf to his face. And one of his interactions is with one of Feanor's more dickish sons, Curufin.
Is there one that isn't?
Maidros. Maidros is actually a pretty decent
Maidros
guy.
Is,
yeah.
That Maidros guy. Yeah, he's okay.
He's okay. So Eol actually stole a Noldor bride and kind of forced her to marry her, and they had a son who ends up destroying the last major, you know, city later on, Elvish city later on. But Curufin catches Eol on the road one day and basically threatens to kill him. When Eol calls him a relative, I have it written down here. I read my own handwriting. He's caught on the road, and Eol says, "If you let, you know, Lord," he's addressing him as Lord, "perhaps you will give me leave to go and discover where my family is." Curufin says to him, "You have my leave, but not my love. The sooner you depart from my land, the better will it please me." Eol mounted his horse, saying, "It is good, Lord Curufin, to find a kinsman thus kindly at need." Kind of like, you know, backhanded. And then Curufin looks darkly upon Eol. "Do not flaunt the title of your wife before me," he said, "for those who steal the daughters of the Noldor and wed them without gift or leave do not gain kinship with their kin. I have given you leave to go. Take it and be gone. By the laws of the Eldar, I may not slay you at this time." So he's like, I don't know, like almost a dog.
So, yeah. So we learn a couple things here about the society. You know, it's sexist.
Right. Right.
Patriarchal is a good name. Yeah. For sure.
Right. Yeah, but then, I mean, there's this wider question of what are Tolkien's motivations with these tales? Can we trust him as a narrator in terms of the viewpoint that he's taking? Because, you know, in that interaction, it's sort of like the Noldor guy is kind of right-ish, mm-hmm. but also, obviously, he's being a jerk, but, like, this guy, like, later goes on to, like, kill lots of people and everything. There's an authorial motivation in terms of Tolkien needs bad guys, and he needs them reasonable. So, like, you know, he needs them to have a grievance. So this is something that goes throughout the entire sort of legendarium, that there's bad guys, they have a grievance that's legitimate, but they go a little too far, right? So, like, the hill people who attack the Rohirrim, you know, yeah, the Rohirrim drove them out of their land, and now they live in horribly unsuitable hill places, and they can't feed their children. But, you know, allying with Sauron is just, like, not cool.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, I think you're right, and that has so much resonance for, you know, again, the kind of, I don't know, the kind of really treacherous and awful relations that can develop between colonized and colonizer.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, like, again, to tie it back to, like, what the, you know, our sensible reason for having this conversation, as wide-ranging and delightful as it is. But no, you really hit on something, though. And that, I think that's, you know, I think that's part of why Tolkien has staying power. And I think, I would say that's a big part of why his stories don't just come across as kind of bland moralizing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's writing in a way that's self-consciously archaizing. He is drawing from the things like, you know, like the Finnish epic tradition and the, you know, Anglo-Saxon traditions and whatnot, where you really do have, like, if you go back and read, like, you know, romances and stuff, there's a lot of stuff that's just like, oh yeah, and the sorcerer was a bad guy. and it was good that Galahad slew him, you know. It's not really, there's not really much sort of, there's not a lot of meat to sink your teeth into regarding how these peoples are interacting and why.
Right.
So I think that's a good reason why Tolkien still resonates, you know. It's stuff that was written, you know, started to be written 80 years ago,
yeah,
by a guy who was trying to sound like he was from, like, 1,000 years before that.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
But I think his own background is influential in how we might want to frame this, because he was born in South Africa and spent significant amounts of time there. His parents spent significant amounts of time there. His son ended up serving during World War II in the Air Force in South Africa. So, like, he's got a lot of links down there.
Right. Go ahead, Ben. No, please. Finish your thought.
For a guy who's educated and not evil, like, who's a genuinely, like, nice person and is educated, but, you know, has to come up with some way to justify, you know, South Africa. Right. there's an element of, like, this must have been a familiar narrative, right?
Sure.
That, you know, okay, look, this domination is not just, but, we've got ourselves into this situation where these people can't be trusted, that they're going to try and kill us.
And all because we did a lot of killing of them. I mean, can you believe it?
But it was so long ago. I mean, surely we can all work this out in a better way than, you know, allying with Morgoth. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's a, and honestly, the way that, I guess the way, Tom, you were describing how the Noldor polities actually existed, you know, in the sort of their colonial realm that they carved out, that honestly, like, there's a lot of parallels with South Africa itself, in that you had, you know, the uber overcast of the British colonial presence. And moreover, but you also had further migrant populations moving into this realm that had previously just been, you know, in the hands of an indigenous people, with the, in the case of South Africa, the, you know, Black South Africans. There's the Bantu speaking peoples and San and Khoi speaking peoples.
Yeah, the numerous local
groups. Right. The numerous and varied, you know, local groups who had been there. But, you know, under the aegis of British colonial domination, there were, of course, the integration of Dutch-descended white settlers with the Boers.
Yep.
There were peoples from all around the rest of the British Empire who would come in and set up shop under the aegis of British colonial domination and form a sort of middle caste. Most famously, we can think about the role that Indian immigrants played
in the
colonial caste system of South Africa. Most famously, Gandhi that was his first big gig, was being a lawyer in South Africa, I'm really laying bare my soul here to say that I am so little of a Tolkienist. I did not know that Tolkien had any connection to South Africa until I looked at the notes for the show and was like, oh damn, yeah. That shines a real light on this.
Like, he himself spent most of his life in England, but the ties there are like crystal clear, I think. And like Christopher Tolkien, who was, I mean, the Silmarillion was just Tolkien's famously arcane, jumbled, unorganized notes, just pieces of paper stuffed in a box. Like, right. Complete mess. Christopher Tolkien, like, even The Lord of the Rings was a mess. Christopher Tolkien, yeah, after the war, came back to England and helped his father sort it all out so that he could make his publishing deadlines and stuff. Right. So then, you know, after his father died, like, they'd been working on Silmarillion for a while, but after his father died, it was Christopher Tolkien, who's still alive, by the way,
yeah,
who's mm-hmm, the one who's still producing these...
I was going to say...
He just retired,
yeah,
actually.
We're still...
Yeah. He just retired before they cut that big Amazon deal.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense,
actually.
Yeah.
He was very protective of his father's, you know, memory and his works, but he was the one who organized the notes and put together what we recognize as the Silmarillion. And this is the guy who spent, you know, a huge portion of his young adult life in South Africa, serving in the Air Force and all that stuff. You know, you could also make a similar argument to what I just said in terms of Tolkien's sort of inherent capitalist tendencies, because you can make a similar argument in terms of an urban underclass. But, you know, that is a different show. the influence from South Africa, I think, is definitely there. It's just,
Even if he wasn't South African, though, just being, you know, British, and glad you mentioned India, for instance, it's all there, you know, even as you kind of talked about, like, a middle caste, like, there are other beings running around Beleriand that aren't just orcs or elves. They're the dwarves. And there's not even one kind of dwarf. There's actually, we discover in the Silmarillion, there's two types of dwarves. There's the dwarfs like Gimli and Thorin Oakenshield that, you know, we all know and love. And then there's the ones that even the dwarves hate, called the petty dwarves, whom they hunted and slew, if I read this correctly.
But then also enter into business dealings with them randomly.
Yeah, and then
we're laughing at the sort of the nonsensical part of that, but that's exactly how colonizers would treat, Aboriginal peoples, especially basically the more technological steps you were ahead of an Aboriginal people, the more it kind of fell into this, like, they're fair game, but we can also enrich ourselves off of them with trade. With Aboriginal Australians.
Yeah,
you
know, that, I mean, that's that a was perfect example. Yeah.
Right. I mean, they were basically treated as vermin by a lot of the British settler, colonial settlers. Yeah. And at the same time, like, yeah, you'd still, like, for survival's sake, like, you would need to trade for food sometimes. It's a very distressing kind of thing to think about.
Just to make things even a little bit worse, before we should probably walk it back a little bit afterwards, but Tolkien definitely, like, there were certain cultural archetypes that he based these different races on, and then took it away from that, because he didn't want to, like, beat people over the head with this stuff.
Yeah, but it was sort of points. He took points of departure, I guess.
Right. So his point of departure for the dwarves was the Jews.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, clearly.
He explicitly said. But, like, the letter that's in public record where he talks about this, he says, the dwarves were definitely my stand-in for the Semitic peoples and the Jews. But, you know, I made them good guys, and I really like them, and they're great, blah, 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 blah. You know, so, 1940s centrist liberal.
In the 30s, he did tell the Nazis to go fuck themselves.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
He's got that going.
Exactly. No.
I always have to end up saying this somehow. I'm Jewish, and I have no beef with Tolkien. He hated the Nazis, like, up one side and down the other, if for no other reason than, you know, he was German and he felt like they were betraying the German heritage and, like, making it look bad. But,
But no,
that said, he was like pro Franco because Franco was like super Catholic,
right? So yeah, like... so it's really. I mean, that's the wonders of the 1930s, my man. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It was a rat's nest of
all the alignments are a little exactly. You know, curvy.
It got zany.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's fascinating you bring it up because like. And you know, is that kind of a legacy of colonial mindset in that there's that trend toward essentializing, right?
Yeah.
Like if you have, you know, there's a group of people, we can identify a group of people and they share these traits and these are the traits that they share and this is how we can talk about them. Yeah. That's extremely useful for a colonizing people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's extremely valuable to colonizing ideology because it basically, you know, if you take away the, if you reduce various populations to having a range of like beliefs or behaviors that they would actually get up to or that you can point to or whatever, that renders your whole colonial administrative apparatus a little easier to do because you can just say like, oh well, you know, I'm an Indian colonial administrator. These villages are Muslims and these villages over here are Hindus, so I'll treat these ones this way and these ones this way.
Are
you familiar with the British Indian warrior mythology or I forget what it, I'm blanking on what it's, the actual words were, but the warrior peoples. That they thought that, you know, there are certain peoples who were natural warriors culturally or genetically or whatever, and they're better. They're the ruling caste,
right?
And they're the ones that the British actively recruited into the Indian units of the British Army.
Yeah, like the Gurkha regiments and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, the Gurkhas, they had a
Gurkhas were specific.
Yeah, very specific. Okay. But like the North Indian the Muslims
Sikhs.
The Sikhs, yes, the Sikhs. Yeah. And there were a couple others, and you know, apologies to any Indian listeners, because I'm. This episode is brought to you by Old Overholt Straight Rye Whiskey, by the way. So, I'm completely blanking on the words and everything, but you know, these were the people that they recruited into the army selectively as part of their colonial administration policy, and it was like. It's so fascinating reading or you know, learning about different ways of justifying this stuff. Like part of it was, you know, for a conservative, like, you know, really bad guy kind of colonial administrator, it was like straight up divide and conquer. But for the enlightened liberal, colonial administrator, it was like, look, not all Indians are savages.
Right.
And these are the people that are okay.
The kind of that's the administration. That's the old sort of benevolent racism.
Yes, you know,
the paternalistic racism.
Paternalistic racism. Yeah.
But in conquering and colonizing, you need to make that designation because you're driving a wedge between the colonized people. And I just want to go back to the petty dwarves for a second in the text.
Exactly.
Oh, please. You know,
so. I came across the word in the language of the Noldor for what they called them. They called them the equivalent of biped animal.
Oh, Jesus.
And they hunted them thinking they were two-legged animals living in caves. And I mention caves because there is a elvish kingdom that's founded by everybody's favorite elf, Finrod Felagund. It's called Norgothrond, the Thousand Caves. And what we learn in the Silmarillion is the petty dwarves had actually started digging those caves, and along came the Noldor and sort of just swept them aside and finished digging the caves and made it one of their great cities and strongholds. And we've been talking a lot about the British and that colonial heritage, but this reminded me so strongly of Pawtuxet, where the pilgrims landed, found an underpopulated area, basically a city already in existence, and just said, well, looks like God cleared the way for us. Yeah. We're going to just build right on top of here.
There's fields, there's houses. This is crazy. Where is everybody? I don't
right,
know.
Right.
God must have made it for us.
Yeah, and there's that across the entirety of the sort of American ideology of the empty continent just waiting for us to be blessed by its bounties. Is that like, you do realize this whole landmass had been under human cultivation for 10,000 years by the time you got there. It had been deeply shaped by human activity.
Yeah.
Just, that's an excellent point, Tom. Yeah.
There's an element of like self-delusion there or something where the native population had just been decimated by smallpox the previous year.
Yeah.
And they were just like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, another, I guess since you're bringing up sort of different sort of types of colonization and how it's reflected in this text a little bit, I wanted to talk a little bit about, there was something in notes about Sindarization.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And Tom, could you explain what you mean by that? And then I'm going to talk about what that reminded me of.
So the Sindar are the ones that are already in Beleriand, right? Now, there's been ages and ages that separate when, say, the Noldor left Beleriand and went to the Undying Lands. In the meantime, they've kind of have a very distinct language from the language that they use in Beleriand. The Sindar speak a different language than the Noldor. The Noldor speak Quenya, I believe, and I don't quite remember Sindarin, I believe, is the other language.
Yes,
Sindarin. So, when they come back, at first they can't talk to each other. They can't communicate. And after a certain amount of time, the Noldor, they're quick to pick up on the language of the Sindar. And it's another implied implication of their superiority, perhaps intellectually, that the Sindar just can't quite pick up Quenya. So that really becomes the lingua franca of Beleriand is Sindar. And once Thingol finds out about the kinslaying where Feanor killed a bunch of elves to steal their ships to bring over here, then burn because he was nuts. Once Feanor did that, once Thingol learns of those actions, he forbids anybody in his realm, and he's still kind of claiming the high kingship of all of Beleriand, but he forbids anyone to speak Quenya.
And it should be said that he was, before everybody left, he was part of the group that got their ship stolen and got killed.
Yeah, like his cousin or something was the leader of the group that Feanor killed. So it was personal. So you have this weird thing where the colonizer's language it becomes really only spoken amongst them, amongst themselves. And that actually reminded me a lot of the Norman invasion. Where French was going to be the language of the court and only the aristocracy, but everyone else still spoke English.
Right.
Right.
And it's interesting. It's actually, I doubt this was intentional, but it's a similar process where, like, the court clung to French hard until all of a sudden in the Hundred Years' War period, they needed buy-in from the populace. Right. And then they were like, we speak English like you! And then all of a sudden English, everybody forgets French. there's a certain element of, the Noldor held themselves as separate until they got mashed into the ground by Melkor and, everybody was living in the Havens and then after the sinking of Beleriand, the Second Age began and the elves moved out into, the rest of Middle Earth. And at that point they're like, well, we're all Sindar, we all speak Sindar, whatever.
Yeah. But what this reminded me of, and this is really, by total coincidence, I've been reading a book that speaks very heavily to this. Because I found myself, okay, guys, have you ever thought to yourselves just how Hinduism and Buddhism made it to Java and Bali?
Like every day.
Like in Indonesia? Yeah.
I've done a bunch of research on this, but It was years ago.
Oh, okay. All right, man. Well, then you probably have read this book that I'm reading. So I got it through Interlibrary Loan, which I'm just going to, hey, quick plug for Interlibrary Loan out there. If you go to your local public library and you search the catalog and they don't have what you're looking for, don't give up. Your librarian almost certainly has access to a program called Interlibrary Loan, where we can go and look around at academic libraries, other public libraries across the country, find the book you're looking for, and get it to you. So don't give up. If it's not in the catalog, we are here to help you out. Anyway.
I have made use of that in my podcast, Wittenberg to Westphalia. So
yes, it is easily one of the coolest things that I get to do at my job. But okay. I also abuse it for my own edification.
Of course. So, what job doesn't?
Exactly. So I got this book called The Indianized Kingdoms of Southeast Asia, which is by a French scholar who, talk about colonialism. He was a French scholar based in Vietnam during the 1930s.
God, Jesus.
But as is so much the case with, like, for us Western people, that's our window in. Like, I mean, I can't even tell you how it squicks me out, but so much Ethiopian scholarship is available to me as an English speaking guy via Italian scholarship. But anyway, I got really curious about it, and I found this monograph about this process, you know, this guy who did this research, and apparently it's a lot of original research, actually going out and finding monuments and stuff. But it's this fascinating story of sort of trade expeditions from India, you know, what is today India. You know, in search of gold, in search of spices, you know, the typical reasons why people would set out on merchant expeditions, especially going to Southeast Asia and what is today Indonesia, where they brought with them, of course, they had a literary society. You know, they had written language, they had a codified religion, or several codified religions at this point. And the Austronesian peoples who inhabited that area had sophisticated societies, but they did not have writing. They did not have, like, these other, you know, kinds of things that were very impressive. And so the theory that this guy worked out, and that's pretty well supported, I would say, is that you would have, you know, it wasn't a matter of mass colonization coming from India, but rather there would be, you know, these expeditions, and someone might, you know, I mean, the people, you know, the local people don't know any better. You could set yourself up as a Brahmin of a noble lineage.
Right, yeah.
Marry into the local elite and establish basically an Indian city-state with you and your homies there at the top, and sort of imparting this culture and this religion on the native Austronesian population.
Right.
And that this transpires sort of independently, basically like, adventurers would set up a kingdom for themselves, you know, and that's how you got the spread of Hinduism and Buddhism. And you have some of the most remarkable Hindu and Buddhist architectures outside of India. It's in Southeast Asia. I mean, think of like Angkor Wat. Think of, I forget the name, but there's a marvelous stupa in Java that's just breathtaking to see.
Yeah.
And now,
which is interesting because Java is like all Hindu, but stupas are anyway. Sorry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And of course, you know, today that region, at least in Indonesia, is almost completely Islamized. But what reminded me of this in your concept of Sindarization is that the peoples themselves there, you had these kingdoms that kind of flourished between, say, like 500 AD to about 1200 AD. And, you know, so that's a good long span of time that left this monumental architecture. The Austronesian people in these areas, you know, the people who would become Vietnamese, the people who would become the Javanese, Balinese, you know, the Indonesian peoples, there was no recollection of these times. They had no idea that these societies existed right where they were. They had no idea that there was this phase in their own history. It had so completely faded from memory. And it was because, you know, eventually you can't, with that huge preponderance of population, just like what happened with the Normans, eventually it doesn't serve any use to keep yourself culturally distinct enough to maintain that distinct culture. And in the meantime, you've imparted massive influence on the quote-unquote natives, so that there have been a lot of religious concepts adopted. There's a lot of vocabulary adopted from Sanskrit and what is today Indonesian and Vietnamese. But the people themselves there were so thoroughly, you know, those elites became Sindarized, in Tom's words, And yeah. and so even the memory of there having been these societies just completely faded from knowledge. It was news to, you know, the kind of the scholarship that this that these scholars, you know, these French scholars were uncovering. It was news to a lot of, well, it was news to everyone there in Indonesia. Yeah. And so you had a lot of this of course inspired a flurry of activity among scholars drawn from the local populations. And that sort of that sparked the second great sort of wave of scholarship about it. It was a fascinating story and a fascinating sort of example of this colonization, which becomes decolonized in a way.
So real quick, huge plug to the History of Southeast Asia podcast by Charles Skimble. The show is amazing. They cover this stuff and it's fantastic. The other thing
that is going on my hit list. Going to write that down. All right. Okay.
Yeah, definitely do it. He's great. He's amazing. Yeah. He's wonderful. So the other a similar process happened in, and this is probably more what Tolkien was drawing from. This show is about Tolkien. the German conquest of Roman Europe, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
The Franks conquering France and the Lombards and then the Franks conquering Italy. You know, you forget that they were there, but there's a huge influence, like, you know, the blood feuds in Italy and you know, there's a huge amount of influence in France as well. So this is like part of the colonization process, that Sindarization.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent parallel. You're right.
Yeah, and for Tolkien, that was much more at the forefront of scholarship at that time. Modern medieval scholarship has sort of accepted, there's a certain amount of that has been discarded, and there's a certain amount of that has been just accepted as fact and everyone's moved on. So that's not talked about so much, but at the time, that would have been the forefront of scholarship, because one of my big drums that I beat constantly in my podcast is the structuralist, the Annales school in France and everything. That was the forefront. That was the height of the bleeding edge of historical scholarship. And Tolkien would have been totally keyed in on that stuff at the time. And the leader of that movement was Marc Bloch. And he was, you know, one of the people who really brought that whole German integration with a Romanized population. He brought that stuff forward and really put that into the public consciousness.
I find often when you're particularly talking about oppressed peoples, and I think a lot of people in Beleriand became oppressed by the Noldor, either directly ruled by them or drawn into their disastrous wars. You know, it becomes important to maybe get perspective of some of those people. It's one thing I really love about Howard Zinn, which we stole the title of this from, this episode, for one of the chapters of A People's History of the United States. There is in an appendices of the Unfinished Tales, which are the stories that Christopher Tolkien couldn't manage to make work within the broader Silmarillion.
Just buried at the back of Beyond.
Just this is in like, you know.
There's some great stuff
there is.
Though. As a person who absolutely loves Tom Bombadil, buy those books. Yeah.
Heck yeah. All right. I'm on board now.
But yeah. I managed to come across a perspective of some of the more lowly elves. And this is kind of flash forwarding many thousands of years more towards the age of people we're familiar with in The Hobbit. Because just like we were talking about, Doriath, Thingol's kingdom earlier, where Thingol is a higher elf than the people he's ruling. Later on, you get Thranduil, who is our friend Legolas's daddy. He is ruling even lower elves.
Right.
And these are called the Sylvan Elves. So this is a Sindar ruling the Sylvan Elves. And these Sindar of Thranduil's line are looking back at their history, and they want to live and mix with the Sylvan and live as the Sylvan. So they want to sort of go native at this point. And they did it deliberately. I'm quoting here. For they and other similar adventurers, forgotten in the legends or only briefly named, came from Doriath after its ruin. And they wished indeed to become Sylvan folk and to return, as they said, to the simple life natural to the elves before the invitation of the Valar had disturbed it.
Right.
So is that... That's,
and it should be... I just want to shout out to the... In the Silmarillion, the description of Middle-earth before the Valar show up. It sounds amazing. He describes it as... And I'm going to do it no justice, but like... Walking around at night with only the stars above all the time, and you know, walking in wonder amongst the starlight and through the trees and everything, and it's a wonderful description.
Yeah.
So just another good reason to read the Silmarillion. So you can see from reading that where they would have wanted to get back to that. Yeah.
And there wasn't just active resentment of the domination of the Noldoran exiles. Mm-hmm. And the attitudes they brought, because really what's laying right underneath what Ben said is what the elves were brought into the world for. The elves were born in Middle-earth, not the Undying Lands. The Valar made a mistake by removing them in the first place.
Yeah.
The elves were supposed to stay in Middle-earth and beautify it. So it was the Valar that swole their heads with pride and really... caused the Noldor in many ways to undertake all the many, many disasters that befell them throughout this history.
But the thing is that one of the things that Tolkien says, you know, getting back to that first part of Silmarillion that we kind of glazed over, where Ilúvatar starts this song that the Ainur continue and then Melkor tries to disrupt, is that three times in the course of the song, as Melkor is disrupting it, Ilúvatar stands up and just completely incorporates Melkor's melody into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Noldor...
Well, that's original sin.
Right.
But
the thing is that Ilúvatar takes that sin and makes it part of his plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
much like Catholic Orthodoxy, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I haven't read all my Aquinas and all the other great systematizers of the Church, but of course there has to be some accounting for the fact that, you know, if God knows what's going to happen, he had to know this was going to happen.
Of course. And so, you know, this is where Tolkien's, you know, Catholicism really shows, but you can sympathize with it because, you know, the Noldor defying the Valar, starting these disastrous wars, ends up delivering the Noldor themselves back to Middle-earth with all the knowledge of the Valar, or at least some harsh portion of it, back into Middle-earth, where then they're set up to deliver that knowledge to humanity.
Right.
Which is then, you know, the sort of the setup for the Lord of the Rings and everything with,
Yeah, because this is the deep history of our own world. Like that's how is conceived in Tolkien's, you know, greater cosmology, is that this is the history of Earth before recorded history.
Right. So despite the mistakes and the evil of Melkor, it all ends up serving Ilúvatar's greater plan because, you know, he goes and, you know, Melkor's evil breaks the calcification of the Undying Lands and brings the knowledge of the Valar back into Middle-earth and then delivers it to humanity and the further development of humanity and the little bit of the divine that is incorporated into humanity.
Yeah. And introduced by these just ferocious jerks.
Which isn't this jerks, exactly how the conquistadors saw themselves?
Well, so that's actually something I'd wanted to come to loop back to in some of what we just said. In terms of these oppressed people, like, we can cast them as oppressed peoples, but there's the way that Tolkien presents it and the way the philosophical argument underlying, you know, a certain portion of colonialism is the element of, you know, well, of course we should rule. We're just better.
Right, right. Yeah.
And that was, you know, at the time that Tolkien was writing, that wasn't a dead philosophical argument the way it is now.
Right, right. But, yeah, that was current. It was, you know, I guess the sentiment is usually expressed in with the cliche white man's burden from that Kipling poem. But right.
But the thing,
oh sorry, go ahead.
But the thing is, it's very easy to get to the white man's burden from classic Greek philosophy. Sure. The whole justification of aristocracy in Plato and Aristotle is like direct line to white man's burden, and that's what Tolkien was drawing
right,
off
right.
of.
And that's true, and it shapes the way that his story is conceived of and the way that it's told. So, you know, while we can view these stories through this kind of this colonial lens, and I think that's appropriate. And mm-hmm. and in a way, it's sort of it's revealing in its own sense the even as like because I don't think Tolkien is necessarily like a he's not some kind of blood and thunder conquer the world colonialist.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
No, absolutely.
But at the same time, like the, you know, there's, so you have in his actual writing this sympathy for people who have been wronged. But at the same time, like, yeah, you're right. Like there's also this very, there's a streak a mile wide of like, well, to make an omelet, you gotta crack a few eggs. So.
You know, or look, can't you just forgive
right,
us?
Right. Bygones be bygones, you know.
Yeah. And that's why probably Tolkien still, you know, every generation's going to find a new way to find Tolkien sure. relevant, I think. And that's probably, you know, for this generation, that stuff is certainly extremely relevant, mm-hmm. where we can recognize the flaws of Tolkien as a person, mm-hmm. You know, recognize how he was of his time, but still find something lovable.
Sure.
in him and in his writing and his works. And, you know, so long as we treat him as a, you know, unreliable narrator, we can still find value and meaning in what
sure.
he says.
And beauty. I mean, we can't get away from the yeah. fact that, like, y'all, I was very surprised by how much I was drawn into it. And that's why I want to go back and give it yeah. like an actual better reading experience than, you know, on my break at work, which because it really deserves it. It was a really tremendous. I'm glad that y'all called me in to help contribute on this because it was a really wonderful reading experience. I'm going to have to actually give it a real go. But I think you're right, Ben. Like, you don't do yourself any service by totally writing off an author or a work because of its fixing in a time and a place. Like and I guess probably my favorite example of that would be like, say, Don Quixote. Don Quixote is a work which was born out in the core of one of the most just brutally rapacious imperial projects of all time, mm-hmm. with the kind of the burgeoning Spanish global empire. Mm-hmm. But that you can't damn it for that, and you read it and you recognize where Quixote himself is skewering so much of the insanity behind I think Tolkien, and again for being very much a, you know, there was no way he was going to be hitting the streets in solidarity with the decolonization movement in the 60s.
No,
but neither is he, sure. you know, neither was he going to be joining the whatever British fascist organizations you had going, like, you know, the 30s and 40s and whatnot. But that's what a remarkably fine conversation. I really love talking to you guys.
Yes. Definitely.
Well, Daniel, when you finish the Silmarillion, if you want to, you know, talk again about it, I'd love to. Tolkien's by far my favorite author. Mm-hmm. And I guess we've really come to an end here, and any final thoughts or final judgments on the Noldor and their actions in Beleriand?
I'll definitely, I guess, just to say, I'll definitely be, you know, reading the Silmarillion in a more serious way, and actually getting at all of that other, God, all the Legendarium that I haven't even looked into yet. I'm really excited about it now, guys. But yeah, I would say, like, I think it's really opened up the way we've been talking about it. The story of the Noldor is easily a much more complete and nuanced picture of a colonizing force than I would have expected from Tolkien. Honestly, like the way we've kind of come at it, the way you guys have shined light on it, I'm walking away pretty impressed with the guy. It's really fascinating, yeah. And it's a great window into the way that imagination, even of an entirely quote unquote, it's supposedly a completely distinct reality being imagined, but of course it has to have points of contact with our own for us to find it relatable. And it was actually a very impressive rendition of the powerful versus the less powerful and how that can shake out.
Yeah, I think this is a really good example of people who do very shallow readings of Tolkien. It's so simple. Everything's black and white, and there's a good guy's always going to win. Well, you read the Silmarillion and you tell me that there's not 600 years of suffering that would make you weep. But like Tolkien is very nuanced, and the fact that we could drill down into what he's actually writing and get what 90 minutes of, I think, substantive things, you know, that goes toe to toe with, you know, I don't know, Martin having, you know, Cersei and his brother, you know, be lovers. I mean, it's just as salacious, sure. It's just as real, and it's just as powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I read Hobbit and Lord of the Rings every year between 2004 and 2016 when my daughter was born, and I had this podcast, and I haven't really had a chance for pleasure reading since 2016. But I will say that this conversation has strongly encouraged me to get back to that yearly ritual and give the Silmarillion another read. And I hope some of you out there will as well. And Tolkien is just such a wonderfully of his time person, but in a good way. It was a unique moment in history where people of good intention could be flawed while still being clearly of good intention. And, I think that's my big takeaway from the Silmarillion and from this conversation.
Well, guys, I was very happy to have this opportunity to talk with you. It's just a wonderful talk. You guys want to give some plugs where people can find you if they don't already know?
Oh, sure. I'll start it off there. The inveterate self-promoter that I am. You can find me yammering on about more great books that I halfway read at The Cannonball, which is another podcast. I kid. I actually do try to read the books there. But yeah, I am.
Let me just interrupt. Heartily endorse The Cannonball.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, guys.
Yes. Thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah, myself and my co-host, Claude Myron Guzer, are on a mission to read all of the books in the Western canon as delineated by noted crank Harold Bloom. you might recognize him from taking an English class at any point in your life. But it's a terrific project, and we have a lot of fun with it. The only reason I could speak about Don Quixote with any authority is because I read it for that show. But yeah, you can find us on iTunes or anywhere else fine podcasts are sold. I don't know if we're on Spotify yet. I'm going to actually have to find out how to do that. But we're also on Twitter at Cannonball Pod, and you can also find us on Facebook. We have a page you can like there. But if you do like to hear people talking about cool books that they read, it is absolutely a great listen. So check it out.
So I'm a completely strange bird. I'm an urban planner by day, but my podcast is about history. It is Wittenberg to Westphalia, the Wars of the Reformation, and it is theoretically about the Wars of the Reformation, which started in around 1500. But of course, my podcast is still doing background. I'm working on the 54th episode right now, and we're about at the year 1100.
And I just want to jump in and say, I am a huge fan of Wittenberg to Westphalia. It is a remarkable achievement, and I'm going to tell y'all something. As a history undergrad and as a former history podcaster myself, Ben is the real, he's doing the real deal by going back that far, and you have to, because it's necessary context, and he does a terrific job. I mean, it's just one of the best history podcasts out there.
Well, I really, really appreciate that. thank you so much. Yeah, so you can check me out, Wittenberg to Westphalia, The Wars of the Reformation. I'm on iTunes, whatever. The Facebook page is Wittenberg to Westphalia. We have Twitter. The website, let's see if I'm too drunk to remember the name. Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast.weebly.com. Yeah, and the next episode is going to be about, well, this couple of episodes that I'm on right now are the history of medieval urbanism. So my two hats are kind of on my head at the same time right now, which is very, very rare. So I encourage you all to check it out. Thanks very much.
And I am Tom Daly, host of the American Biography Podcast. I think if you've listened to any of the former Agora podcast feed podcasts, you've already heard me say this. But I am on @American_bio on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. And actually, all of us just joined Flick.
Yes.
That's true. Which is actually a pretty cool new medium. They are a sponsor of the Agora Podcast Network. And it's a great place for a conversation where I keep calling it the Garden of Eden because I haven't run into a troll there yet.
It's been pretty blissful so far. Yeah. And also, I want to say, Tom, that you are a history podcaster's history podcaster.
Yes.
American Biography is an absolutely terrific show. Everybody should go listen
Thank
to
you.
It.
I agree.
One day I'll actually finish The Life of John Marshall. It hasn't happened yet.
You know, and, look,
2019's not looking great, but maybe 2020.
Tom, far be it from me to criticize you for taking your time on your background episodes, but your show is fantastic and I absolutely adore it. So everyone should listen to that as well.
Oh, well, thank you guys. I appreciate that. And now this little love-in comes to an end. thank you all for listening so much. And gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. And thanks for the great conversation.
Absolutely. Y'all have a great night.
Yep, you too. Bye-bye.
Or a day.
Here ends the podcast. If it has passed from the high and the beautiful to darkness and ruin, that was of old the fate of Arda Mared. And if any change shall come and the marring be amended, Manwe and Varda may know, but they have not revealed it, and it is not declared in the dooms of Mandos.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.